Good afternoon. I'm Linda Dow. It's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Manuela Joanno to talk about post-traumatic stress disorder and moral injury. Dr. Joanno is a physician living in Perth who has over 30 years' experience as a family physician and emergency physician. In the past 8 years, she has been focusing on developing innovative approaches to helping military members, veterans, first responders, and frontline medical professionals who are affected by PTSD and especially moral injury. Dr. Joanno, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you for the invitation.
Now, could we start with having you explain to us what PTSD is exactly?
Post-traumatic stress disorder is what PTSD stands for, and it is a condition that's been fairly well recognized and defined in our diagnostic and statistical manual, or the DSM, which is sort of like the Bible that the psychiatrists and psychologists use to come up with diagnoses. So really, it's a condition that your body and brain can adopt if you've been subjected to traumatic experiences. And a traumatic experience that is really life-threatening, life-altering, or, you know, maybe involves an actual death. Or it could be from a severe sexual trauma as well. So there's some very significant types of symptoms that go along with PTSD that have been fairly well characterized. And there's good treatment, good news.
Okay. Now, how would you define moral injury? What does that mean?
So moral injury is a concept that's just fairly recently come on the horizon, and people are recognizing this is a real thing. But I think most people have recognized that moral injury has been a significant cause of human suffering for many, many centuries, and probably for as long as human beings have been on Earth. So we have a working definition for moral injury. And that is, moral injury is really an injury to the heart and soul of a person, to the very being of a person that makes you, in effect, a human being. And it can happen when maybe you did something you wish you didn't, or you didn't do something that you wish you did, or you didn't do it fast enough and there were dire consequences. Or maybe you witness things that are just plain wrong and you're powerless to stop it. And, you know, we see these sorts of things happening for people who are, say, on a peacekeeping mission where they were witnessing horrific things happening to innocent people in front of them, but they were told, no, you can't intervene. This is not why you're here. You just have to stand and sort of hold the peace. So that causes a significant amount of moral injury to some of our military folks. And then there's also this thing that we call institutional trauma or sanctuary trauma, which is another type of moral injury that can happen when, you know, you may feel like you wore your uniform with pride, you put yourself out there, you were willing to put your life on the line in service, and you thought that your organization would be there to help you and support you if things go sideways, but instead you find that, you know, you're not treated well and maybe even blamed for things, or you have, you know, SIU investigations, like special investigations if you're involved in, you know, a police activity that caused harm to someone or was in any way questionable. There's lots of different ways that institutional trauma can impact people. So the symptoms of moral injury are very different from those of PTSD, but they're usually involving a sense of shame, guilt, overwhelming sadness, or this institutional trauma, there's often a sense of betrayal or anger or injustice. So we have people that come to us that have, you know, all the classic PTSD symptoms of hypervigilance and reliving the incidents through intrusive thoughts and nightmares, and having avoidant behavior, as well as having a sort of overall psychological numbness, which are the hallmark symptoms of PTSD.
Who are the people most affected that you would see by PTSD and moral injury? What are their occupations? Oh.
Our program has been specifically offered to folks from the military, whether they're serving members or veterans who've retired from active service in the military. We also have had quite a large number of police officers, paramedic firefighters, correctional officers, We have had frontline physicians and nurses attend our programming as well. But, you know, anybody who is in any position where they're responding to any type of crisis, critical situation, or, you know, seeing human suffering on a regular basis, but they can certainly be at risk for developing this type of PTSD.
On a personal level, I'm just wondering what led you to want to help these people, to focus on that?
Well, I've had some people close to me that have had, you know, significant struggles, and I've seen the toll that it's taken on individuals who are really struggling with, you know, the severe symptoms of PTSD. And I always had the sense that we have to do more. And, you know, being in the emergency department for over 30 years, I guess, you know, you see things that are really difficult to get your mind around and try to process and make peace with in such a way that you can continue working and be useful for the next people you have to see. So I guess thing I've really thought about a lot. And I really felt that, you know, PTSD is one thing, but I just didn't feel like we were really getting a good grip on the entire breadth of the injury. And I really felt like we needed to widen our arcs of fire, so to speak, to be a little bit more inclusive and realize that, you know, the effects on humanity, these moral injuries, very often are what cause the burden of suffering. So I really started diving into this probably 9 years ago, and I've learned so much. And what we've learned really isn't in the textbooks, and it's really not in the medical literature. We've learned what we've learned from sitting with people who are truly suffering, who trusted us enough to let us know what's really going on with them.
Right. I'm just wondering, when was PTSD first recognized as a disorder, and how successful has standard treatment been up to this point?
Well, it was only in the last edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which came out in 2013, I believe, where PTSD was given its own category, like it was recognized as a distinct diagnosis. Before that, you know, there was lots of things in the literature where it was sort of lumped in with anxiety disorders in general. And we know about, you know, battle fatigue and some of the other things that were recognized in soldiers. It was given different names, but it was certainly, you know, shell shock was another one. So over the last, you know, centuries, it's definitely been described, but hasn't really found its place in the diagnostic manual until this latest edition in 2013. So what are we doing about it? I mean, medication is very often first line, psychotherapy, trying to help people, you know, feel more anxious, help to deal with the intrusive thoughts, nightmares. A lot of cognitive behavioral therapy or cognitive processing has been utilized. Exposure therapy, where you start helping people face things that might have become fears because of their experiences, so that can be helpful. But we have really found that helping people find a new lens, find a new way to process what they've been through, and find some way to gain some idea of meaning. They did not go through all this for nothing, and their story's not over yet. We really feel that that's the way forward. I don't personally feel that we have come to a place where we're very effective in terms of our medical system and psychological services, that we're as effective as we can be, and we're always striving to do better. But I really do feel that we need to stop looking at this as a disorder. You know, the sort of this collection of symptoms that we call PTSD are really normal reactions of your body trying to protect you from further trauma. So I don't like it when we pathologize things the way we do. There is help.
Right. And, you know, I was going to ask you this question, and can a diagnosis be actually a two-edged sword? Good to be able to name and understand what's wrong, but on the other hand, maybe it's a label that can stigmatize as well.
Oh, absolutely. Much as we try to say that we're trying to do away with the stigma, it's unfortunately very much still around, and a lot of people don't realize that this is something that can be treated. The earlier, the better. I think very often people are afraid of saying or doing the wrong thing, so they very often tiptoe around people who they may feel have a diagnosis or already, you know, have been diagnosed. So I think there's lots of work that can be done. And, you know, what we've learned is it doesn't matter how strong, well-intentioned, well-trained or experienced you are. You get too close to the fire, anybody can get burned this way. Mm-hmm. So it happens to anybody, and even the strongest people. So we really need to question this idea that people who develop, you know, symptoms of PTSD are somehow weak or deserve to be stigmatized, because it's not that way at all.
How does the brain process trauma? And I'm wondering how traumatic does an event have to be to actually cause this problem?
Well, to get a pure diagnosis, you have to have a trauma that is life-ending, life-threatening, or a severe sexual trauma. Or, you know, it can be also happening if you're someone who's had to continuously look at, you know, the details of sordid events. So we see that in people who are called to jury duty, mm-hmm. or people who work for CAS, or, you know, people who work as correctional or probation officers. And judges and lawyers, they're not immune, that's for sure. So certainly it has to be a very significant sort of trauma. You don't get PTSD just because your boss yelled at you or didn't give you your holiday. So we have to be careful we don't banter the idea of PTSD around too much. But really, you know, what we're calling PTSD is really the brain's attempt to prevent you from getting into another situation where, you know, you could be injured or killed. And it goes way back to the way our brain has developed, right? I mean, example we always use, if you were a cave person and you were down by the river picking berries and, you know, you just barely got away from a saber-toothed tiger, your brain are going to start to react pretty significantly when you're thinking about going back to that same river to, you know, pick the berries again, because your body is going to be on guard and it's really going to be very much aware that no, this is a danger, and you're going to be given all the danger flashing signals. And that's kind of how the hypervigilance can be born. And again, you know, when you've had something very traumatic, your brain wants to record it in a way that it's easily retrievable. If you ever find yourself in a similar situation, you know, you're going to definitely avoid it. And a very simple example of that is, you know, everybody can remember where they were September 11th when the planes crashed into the towers there. Everyone knows where they were, who they were talking with, what time of day it was when they first heard about it.
Right.
But you don't have to remember what you had for lunch 3 weeks ago, because mm-hmm. you just record things like that unless they have a very strong emotional impact. So our brains are very much geared to protecting us from further danger and threats.
Does an event have to be quite traumatic, though, to affect someone? I'm not saying, you know, that they would have PTSD necessarily, but something that less minor than say going to war, being a police officer, being an emergency room physician, you know, something a little less traumatic than that. Does the brain still see that as trauma?
And For sure it does. And a lot of people will see something traumatic in their everyday life. It just happens to be where you are at the time. Or, you know, a lot of people have near misses. I think most people can think of a time in their life where something very scary almost happened to them, or they did have something happen to them. So there's lots of ways that people can be affected by something that's traumatic. And of course, things also are very personal, especially when we're talking about moral injury. There are some things that will impact a person much more severely based on their own past experiences, maybe their own personal fears that may have developed over time. So it, you know, some people may feel like, what happened to this person doesn't seem to be that big a deal. Like, why are they so upset about it? But it is very a personal thing. And the other thing I wish people would understand is something we've certainly learned, is that sometimes a near miss is recorded your brain just as, you know, acutely and significantly as if something really bad did happen.
Is that right?
Parent that's terrified that something bad happened to your child because you don't know where they were, they've disappeared, you can't reach them for a while. Just that type of worry and that extreme emotional reaction can be put in your brain in such a way that it definitely leaves an impact, and you're going to be feeling the effects of it if you ever come across that situation again.
Yes. I'm wondering if triggers, that happen, do they have to be necessarily related to the initial event?
No, because things are definitely recorded in your memory banks. And, you know, things that remind you of anything, even distantly, can become what we call triggers. You know, subconscious mind is very, very active and very interesting. And, you know, your subconscious mind can pick up any kind of cue. It can pick up any little sight, sound, smell, or might remind you of something else. It may get into your conscious mind. You know, you could be driving along and, you know, go past a school and hear little kids playing and in the playground, but that sound might remind you of something else that was triggered for the time. So yes, your brain gets these signals from your subconscious that, you know, this could be something dangerous. And you can have these sort of flashbacks or trigger type feelings without even knowing where they came from.
We're just about out of time, and I'm just wondering if there's anything that you would like to add that we haven't already covered today.
So what we try to do is we really try to get people to feel the genuine feelings. We try to take them out of their head where they're really overthinking things very often and try to get them feeling more of their actual symptoms and what it is their body's trying to tell them. You know, so we kind of change things around. We know that if someone's really anxious and hypervigilant, their concentration isn't always really good. And sometimes trying to reason with a brain that's pretty frazzled isn't always that productive. So sometimes we, you know, we use the approach that to feel better, sometimes you have to have better feeling, because the numbing that happens with PTSD really tends to cloud, just kind of push a lot of things away from the brain. So we really try to get people back into their body. We try to do a lot of somatic work that way. We try to calm the body down so that people can have a better handle on what it is that's really causing their pain and what they need to do to address the things that, you know, need to be addressed. I think your body and brain are trying to tell you that things have not sat right with you. You just haven't been able to make peace with some of the things. So you're pushing it away. You don't want to remember. You don't want to have those, you know, impulsive thoughts and flashbacks. You push them away, which is so exhausting. But when you can get yourself into a calmer place where you feel safe and you're ready now to face some of these things, sometimes that's when you can process them and put them to rest for good and move forward.
Right. It sounds like you're creating a safe environment for people to feel that they can relax and come out with some of their feelings. Would this be like group discussions? And are there, you know, physical things that you do, exercises with these people that you're helping or what?
Yeah, we have quite a few elements in our 6-day residential retreat, where we do really try to get people out of their heads, like I said, and more into feeling things in their body. And yes, we have to make a safe environment for them. And the group work is so powerful. You know, we know that as human beings, we come into this world and we're hardwired for struggle and for challenges and for difficulties. That's just our inheritance. But the flip side is we're also hardwired for connection. And that's how humans have always gotten through all the trials in life, right? All the difficulties, how they've been able to protect each other through wars and famines and natural disasters, is we've leaned on each other.
Right.
So this type of therapy in the group processes that we use is so valuable. And I think it's the only way, really, especially when it comes to healing from moral injury.
I want to thank you very much and wish you well in this important work that you're doing. And thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you, Linda, for your interest, and thanks for allowing us to get the messages out there.
You're very welcome. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye now.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Dr. Manuela Joanno has been speaking about innovative approaches to treating PTSD and moral injury. I'm Linda Dow. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.